rise. The Court of Appeals Division 1 is now in session.
Thank you all. Please be seated. This is time set for oral argument in our case number CACB 250552. Let's see. Constantine versus Constantine. Each side is allocated 20 minutes for oral argument. The appellant may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal if you wish to do so, but if you wish to do so, you need to keep track of your own time at the podium clock. Out of respect for counsel and to avoid any confusion, I would ask that everyone in the courtroom make sure your cell phones are turned off so our proceedings are not interrupted. We've read the briefs. We've conferenced the case. We'd encourage you to keep that in mind as you present oral argument. Also, proceedings are being recorded and will be posted to YouTube in due course. So please, as you begin your presentation, tell us your name and the party that you represent. With that, Mr. Jensen, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good afternoon. My throat's a little bit dry today, so hopefully it will hold out for the next 20 minutes. My name is Kevin Jensen with Genesis Legal Group, and I represent the appellant Tino Constantine in this matter. Your Honors, I want to start by going through exactly what we're asking this court to do in terms of the trial court's ruling. And there are four or five different things that we're asking the court to address on this appeal. First of all, we're asking the court to overturn the trial court's classification of the interests of the community property. The trial court found that they were 50; they should be divided 50-50, and that they were community property.
As to which entity are you speaking of there? Because if my reading of it is correct, two of the entities were classified as separate property with 50% ownership, and one of the entities was community property.
Correct, but the court divided them 50-50 across the board. So there's one, as you correctly pointed out, Your Honor, that was deemed community property. I think that was the Cafisia LLC. The other two were separate property, but the court still divided those 50-50. We're saying the court got it wrong in both instances, and we're asking the court to reverse that.
And counsel, I'll interrupt you again.
I'm sorry,
but you agree that the court had the jurisdiction to allocate all of these entities. I get that you challenge how they were allocated, but there's no question that the family court had, in your mind, that the family court had the jurisdiction to make those allocations.
That's correct, Your Honor. We do not dispute that.
Thank you.
I know that we probably made a statement contrary to that, but and I'll address that, but we do not dispute that. Second, we're asking this court to remand back to the trial court with instructions to recognize the assets and interests as separate property, or as the case may be, dissolve and wind up the LLCs in an orderly manner, as opposed to sort of the fire sale that the trial court ordered, and apply distribution of the property via the LLC laws, where the initial capital contributions are returned to the owner and the balance divided.
Sorry to interrupt you,
yeah,
but are you saying that the court improperly categorized them as community property when the court awarded property as separate property 50% to each party? That's different than saying the court categorized the property incorrectly.
There is one scenario where the court did categorize it incorrectly. That was the Cafisia property. That was a situation where the property, where wife signed a disclaimer deed, and I believe that the court classified that as community property.
Well, the property or the LLC interest, because that's two different things.
Well, the LLC interest as well.
If we're in LLC land, go ahead. We'll wait. I'll let you get started.
And I'm fine answering questions.
Let me just ask. If we're in LLC land, can members of an LLC reach agreements that may be different than, say, each person is entitled to what they contributed to the LLC? Can they have an operating agreement that says we own everything in this LLC 50-50?
They can. I don't think there's any dispute that is completely acceptable under LLC laws. we don't have operating agreements in this case.
We don't have a written operating
agreement. We don't have any written operating agreements, and we dispute that there's an oral operating agreement. Now,
is that a question of fact that we review on an abuse of discretion standard? I mean, is that the judge engaging in fact finding that there was in fact an oral operating agreement as to the operation of these three LLCs?
I don't think that the trial court found that there was an oral operating agreement. I know that there was a finding that there was. I think the way that the trial court actually phrased it, that you could infer from the party's actions that there was an agreement. I'm not sure that the court ever distinguished it as being an oral operating agreement versus some other type of an agreement.
Well, we know there's not a written agreement. So he says we can infer an agreement. Isn't he inferring an oral agreement between the two parties?
I think that's what the court did, but I think our position is that the court got that wrong. And this is certainly a situation where...
Are you saying there's no evidence that the court could have, from which the court could have reached that conclusion, or you just disagree with the court's interpretation of the evidence?
There's no evidence by which the court could reach that conclusion, Your Honor. If you look at the trial transcript, wife was asked about this agreement. Now, let me back up a little bit, if I may. This issue actually did not even arise until wife... made this claim or made this argument in their pretrial statement. So this was not something that they were claiming all along. We filed our pretrial statements at about the same time as we almost always do in family court cases. And so we never really got to address this issue head on. So this is something that arose in the pretrial statement. At trial, wife was asked the question about this oral agreement. And I think at most she testified to was that the parties agreed to place the properties in an LLC. That's fine. We're not necessarily disputing that that's impermissible. I think you can certainly do that. But if we're going to go back to LLC land, what we have to do is look at what the statute says. And the statute says that you can have an oral agreement related to an oral operating agreement on a specific issue. But if the issue, which in this case is the interest and the distribution of the property, if the oral agreement or written agreement doesn't address that, then you have to defer back to the statute in order to determine what should be.
Can you just have an overall agreement that we're going to put it into an LLC that we're going to jointly own and we'll each have a 50-50 interest in?
You can have that if you make that specific, and that's the problem here. That was never specifically stated. The only evidence that was presented at trial, if the court even infers this as dispositive, was wife's testimony that we agreed that we would put the properties in an LLC. Okay, that's fine. But that doesn't tell us what we're going to do with the properties afterward. That doesn't tell us how we're going to distribute it. That doesn't give us any indication at all as to what the parties are going to do with their LLC or the properties in the LLC beyond just putting them in the LLC. And that's the problem. The court went far beyond what the parties may have agreed to and said, because you agreed to put them in the LLC, everything is 50-50, and that's not what the LLC law is.
What if they had just said, we're going to pool our resources, and they just both put their money into a bank account, and they haven't put, it's not a 50-50, but we've agreed to pool our resources, and this is going to be our account. Both our names are going to be on it. What would the result be there?
Pulling resources is a little bit different than determining what their rights are as to the assets afterwards. And a key point here is every single one of the properties that were donated or contributed to the LLCs were all titled in my client's name as his sole property, or in the case of the property, the wife signed the disclaimer deed. She disclaimed her interest. So your scenario...
I'm sorry, are you saying... at which point are we talking about that all three of the properties were in your client's sole name? Now, my understanding is, at least as to Tino Menlo and Katina Saffron, that there's no dispute that the wife contributed at least some funds to the purchase of those properties, and that the rest of the money, or the bulk of the money, came from a 1031 exchange done by your client. Am I mistaken about that?
There is a dispute as to whether or not wife contributed money to those properties. I believe that the trial testimony from wife was that she gave my client some money. He purchased the properties. The evidence that was presented at trial is that those properties were purchased by my client and titled in his name. So,
wasn't there evidence that she provided funds from the sale of her residence?
That was her testimony. We're not disputing that she testified to that. But I would argue that if somebody is going to contribute money to the purchase of a property, they would have it titled as joint property or joint tenancy or something along those lines.
Well,
she
not if you're
that.
Planning on putting it right into an LLC that's owned 50% by each of you, right?
No, and I don't think you still have to do that. I mean, this court has said over and over that title is what rules in these cases, in these real property cases.
But aren't you just saying the only thing I thought what you were arguing regarding the LLC was husband's entitled his contribution from it, but the LLC, the parties that own the LLC are both husband and wife. Is that not the argument that he gets his contribution and then it's split 50-50, or is he saying all of it should have gone to him?
I'm not 100% sure I understand the question. Let me answer it, and if I get this, okay. if I'm not answering your question, you can let me know. What we're arguing is that we're not arguing that husband gets 100% of the proceeds from the properties.
And then what's the basis of wife getting? She's a member of the LLC.
Right.
What percentage was she supposed to get, in your view?
Well, I think that that's best answered by looking at the LLC laws in terms of distribution upon winding up of an LLC.
Yeah, but let's say he got out what he put into it.
Okay,
then
right.
How are you going to distribute the rest of it?
Yeah, thank you. I think I understand your question now. Yeah, our position is that the capital contribution should be returned to husband in each case, and then the remaining profits, we'll call them profits, the remaining funds, should be divided equally between the members of the LLC. Or I think the statute says equally. We have two members here. So in that situation, 50-50. But the key here is that the capital contribution under the statute must be returned to my client. And that's really one of the main thrusts of our case here, is that he contributed substantial sums of money as capital contributions that were not returned. She basically got 50% of his capital contribution, and that is
where
the court got.
That's clearly the result, unless there was an agreement to the contrary.
Unless there was an agreement to the contrary.
And I'd like to return to that point, if I could, that you had said, I believe, earlier in the argument that there needed to be some sort of specificity about the operating or that this agreement was an operating agreement. And I'm going to read to you from the definition of operating agreement contained in the LLC statute. That's 2931.02. It says operating agreement means the agreement whether or not referred to as an operating agreement and whether oral implied in a record or in any combination thereof. That sounds pretty broad, doesn't it? I mean, an oral implied agreement is sufficient to be an operating agreement. Why was your friend's client's testimony about what she understood the arrangement to be, why can that not be an operating agreement under the LLC statutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think if I understand your question, the way I would answer that is that under the statute, let me get the reference here because I want to make sure I get this right. I think it's 2931.05 is the statute that addresses this. Section B says that to the extent the operating agreement does not provide for a specific provision, then this chapter governs the matter. And so if there's not a specific issue addressed in the operating agreement, the oral operating agreement, using your example, such as sharing assets 50-50 or how we're going to distribute upon winding up, then you have to go back to the statute.
And right? I don't think there's any disagreement on the bench that those are the default rules. But again, the statute seems to indicate that you can enter into an agreement contrary to what the statutes provide. And it does seem that when we say oral implied agreements could be an operating agreement, that seems like a pretty broad category of things here. I'd ask you to address why the wife's testimony in this particular case doesn't meet that test where the court could consider that to be an operating agreement.
Well, I think again, Judge, there's only one line of questioning, one area of testimony that she provided. And I believe all that she said at trial, all that she testified to at trial, is that the parties agreed to put the properties in an LLC. That's it. I mean, we can put anything in the LLC. You know, we can put racing horses or cars or whatever the case may be, but they didn't discuss, there's nothing in that statement that you can infer that they also agreed that everything after that would be divided equally. We're just putting something in the LLC.
No, but you're agreeing that it's going to be divided equally. All you're saying is husband was entitled to pull out what he put in. But so if there was if we can infer from her testimony that she understood that everything was going to be divided equally, including what he put in, isn't that an inference the court could have drawn?
Well, certainly that's what the court did in this case, but I don't know that there's I can't think of a rule or statute that allows the court to just say what you think. You know, you have a right to reasonably rely on what you think should have happened. You know, if we're going to default back, if you're not going to have...
But it's not what she thinks. She's saying this is our agreement, and we can agree to whatever we want. It doesn't really have to be a reasonable agreement, but this is what we agreed to.
And I'm not trying to push back on the court, but again, I would go back to the fact that the only thing that you can infer that they agreed on was placing properties in an LLC. I don't think that you can extrapolate from that or go beyond that and say, in addition, we're going to divide everything 50-50, because that's not what happens in many LLCs. That's why we have specific operating agreements, and if there was something more than that, there was no evidence presented at court that would support that particular position, Your Honor. Lots of good questions. I appreciate that. I see that I have about 4 minutes left, and what I think I would like to do, Your Honor, is, unless you have any additional questions, I will reserve my remaining 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you. Counsel.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Hsu.
Yes. My name is Michael Hsu. I represent the appellee, Catherine Constantine. The court was faced with a unique situation in that this court had already provided some guidance to the court about how to address the issues in apportioning property when there was no written operating agreement regarding the ownership of the LLCs or the capital contributions for either the premarital or the postmarital agreements. In their opening brief and in the reply brief, the appellant focuses on, well, that holding was limited to the facts that were present there, that there had been an agreement on the record in a temporary orders hearing that the intervener owned 50% of the membership interest in the Athens LLC.
But didn't that decision specifically leave unanswered how these parties would divide the other 50%?
Well, I think that the essence of the holding that I think the court took, the Superior Court took from that, was that spouses who are members of a closely held limited liability company who have oral or implied agreements on their membership interests and the manner in which distributions will be made can be upheld. And I think there's other cases that touch
on. I agree.
That.
I'm just not. I wasn't reading the decision in that previous case as having any suggestion as to what that agreement was as between these two parties. It was a decision that related to the father-in-law, but it specifically left unanswered how it's going to be divided here.
It did, Your Honor. And what's interesting is when you look at the proposed findings of fact that the appellant filed after the trial, after the evidence had been presented as to the Athens 6437 LLC, he said each party owns 25% and should receive 50% of the remaining funds that were held in counsel's IOLTA. And so he didn't distinguish anything. He basically conceded that there had been sufficient evidence that had been presented at the trial And that's not even an issue that he's raised in his
own agreement. Well, that's a different LLC, right?
It is. Yeah, that was the one that was at issue in the first appeal.
Could you go to the questioning we were asking regarding the testimony, or what's the best evidence that Wife presented that there was a 50-50 agreement as to everything, not just what's left over after the amount that was contributed is returned?
There's actually a fair amount of evidence that consists of documentary evidence that it's not solely limited to my client's testimony. It was the articles of organization for each one of these LLCs, premarital
and post. But they don't say much other than there are two members and here's who they are. It doesn't say, you know, that they're 50% owners or that upon dissolution of this particular LLC that the property that they contain will be distributed 50-50, right? I mean, it's just a fairly vanilla article of organization.
It is a form, but it's relevant to the extent that in family court proceedings and dissolution proceedings, the burden to prove separate property interest it is on the party that asserts that claim by clear
and
convincing
evidence.
Well,
but I mean, these LLCs, two of the three, were formed before the marriage, weren't they?
Yeah, that is correct. That is correct. They were. So each party received a membership interest in those LLCs prior to the marriage, which constituted their separate property under ARS 25-213.
Okay. So beyond the articles of organization, what other testimony was there that the agreement was, is that upon the wrapping up of these LLCs, regardless of the contribution, that each spouse is going to receive 50%?
There was a K-1 statement for one of the LLCs that showed that each of them owned, it was the Athens LLC, each of them owned 25% of it. There was the wife's testimony regarding how they had distributed money to each of them over the course of the marriage. They would give each of them checks for similar amounts. There was the testimony that goes back all the way that wife offered that the parties had commingled their accounts going all the way back to 2012.
But that's a commingling of bank accounts. That's not commingling of real property or LLC interests, right?
Well, I think they were commingling separate property, even from separate individual bank accounts, then that ended up in LLC bank accounts. And so there was post-marital commingling too.
But there was no question, though, that the amount of separate money was put in to start the LLC. There was a 1031 exchange. No question about that amount. That nothing commingled about that amount that went in to that LLC. Is that right?
So what's interesting, if you take a step back from this case, husband takes the position, and I think I'm going to answer the question in a roundabout way, but husband takes the position in this case that these quitclaim deeds that were signed by husband to transfer his ownership interest, which divested him of his own ownership interest, and placed it in the name of these LLCs, which the Superior Court referred to as holding companies. When it came to the transfers of those LLCs, of the quitclaim deeds for the transfer of his interest into the LLCs, he says, oh, well, no, I didn't intend to make a gift. That's not what I was doing at all. But when it came to the reverse situation, where wife quitclaimed an interest into husband through the Athens 6437 LLC, he doesn't object to that. His proposed finding, in fact, he says, yeah, of course that's community property. So he can't have this both ways, where, you know, a transfer of an ownership interest in real property from an individual spouse to an LLC is not a gift when it hurts him. But it is a gift, and it transmutes the character of that asset into community property when it benefits him. Okay, and that was the facts of the Athens matter. Is that that property had initially been purchased by my client, by her parents, and then husband set up the Athens 6437 LLC, and they transferred. And that is indicia, I think, of this overall plan that you sort of touched on, Your Honor, where sort of one for all and all for one.
Well, it's indicia, but it's not preclusive. I mean, those are four separate transactions. Athens is not before us at this point. With these other three LLCs, the transfers were done on different days at different times. What you're saying isn't obvious to me that those couldn't peacefully coexist.
That they couldn't be what? I'm sorry.
Peacefully coexist. I mean, they do cut one way. I completely understand your point, but maybe they did.
Right. Well, I think the Superior Court looked at it in sort of a global way. There had also been evidence that had been presented, for example, that the appellant transferred his separate home that they lived in as their marital home prior to marriage by signing a quitclaim deed into my client's name individually. He doesn't contest that in appeal at all. It is deemed community property, and he's not arguing that he's aggrieved by that order. There was testimony that he designated my client the beneficiary of the of his estate. There was testimony that he took the affirmative step after they got married to go back to the Corporation Commission and amend the Articles of Organization to reflect the name change, even, of my client from Bafalakis to Constantine post-marriage.
How's designating her as the beneficiary of his estate help your position at all? That just means whatever he owns is going to go to her when he dies. That doesn't mean she gets something if they get divorced.
I think it reflects just this overall agreement that they were pooling their resources, regardless of unequal contributions to the creation of their wealth. They were using LLCs and trying to manage within the same taxpayer rule for two of them, for the 1031 exchanges, which required that to avoid the capital gains taxes on the sale, the same seller had to be the buyer. So that meant Mr. Constantine had to take it. And so when my client contributed property, funds, money, to the purchase of that, her testimony was, we did that in reliance on him saying, ultimately, this is going to end up in an LLC that we both own. We're both going to get half of it. And so that's why I think, so that's the type of evidence I think that the court just sort of piled on top of each other. And then there was the absence of evidence. There were issues that Mr. Constantine didn't even address in his pretrial statement. There were issues that he conceded in the course of the trial regarding the marital home, when he basically just conceded that was community property. There are things that occurred that I think reasonably led the court to conclude that there was an oral agreement, and that's the language that is in the decree. The parties had an oral agreement regarding each party's membership interests and distributions to the members. That, I think, built on the holding in Constantine 1 in that first appeal, and I think it's not an abuse of discretion for the Superior Court to have applied that holding in that manner with the same parties, with similar facts regarding these other real properties and the other limited liability companies. And I don't think if the court were to remand, the Superior Court is a court of unified jurisdiction. The family court had authority under Title 45 to dissolve their marriage and apportion community property and debt. It also had authority under Title 29 to address the counterclaim that he filed, that he asked for, that he never amended after the memorandum decision was filed in Constantine 1, where he said, liquidate these LLCs, dissolve them.
The dissolution of the LLCs, the liquidation of the LLCs, was that essentially tried by consent? Were both parties sort of on board that, while I understand there was a disagreement between you and your friend about how those funds were to be allocated, was there a disagreement about whether the court somehow was improperly ruling on the dissolution of these LLCs?
Not from our side of the aisle. And the we actually filed the motion to join them, to ensure that the Superior Court they were named as parties and that they would be subject to the court's jurisdiction. It wasn't that situation like a recent Westbrook rental case where there was a list of pendants that had been filed, but the entity itself had not been joined in litigation. And this court said that was error. It was abuse of discretion to proceed in that way. And so that was the thinking then. There had been an old case, Tomatich, I think was the name of it, that stuck in my mind around the time that this matter was initiated, where we knew that there were these LLCs that was the titled owner of this property, the owner of record, and we knew that we were going to need the Superior Court potentially to enter orders relating to the disposition of the property that was owned by those LLCs. And so that's why we filed the motion to join them. We never argued, to be more direct, that the court did not have jurisdiction to address or adjudicate the claims that he filed in his counterclaim under Title 29.
Can I ask you to address a slightly different issue? It seems to me in the briefing that there is this issue at the end of the decree about the payment of taxes.
Yes.
And that there may be some agreement between the two sides that what the court had come up with was not sufficiently clear to really tell the parties what's supposed to be happening with those taxes.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for that. That was one of the things that I wanted to make clear, that my client did not take the position at trial that she would not be responsible for payment of 50% of the capital gains taxes that would be due related to the sale of the properties that he had previously owned that he had gifted to her. That the narrower issue that I think the trial court just, maybe some clunky language or inarticulate language perhaps, could lead a person to believe that the court was requiring Mr. Constantine to pay 100% of the capital gains taxes. The issue that brought that up and that led to that order was that when the Athens property had been sold, Mr. Constantine did not disclose information regarding the sale to allow my client to properly disclose for tax purposes her share of any profits once she would receive them. And I think that's what the court was intending to address. And beyond that, it read literally that order applied to the tax period for 2025. None of those properties have been sold in 2025 that were the subject of the decree. And so to that extent, the order doesn't apply anyways. But you have me on the record in avowing that my client does not maintain the position that she is not responsible for payment of 50% of those capital gains taxes. She is, in fact, responsible for half of those.
Okay. And obviously, your position is that we should stand by the decree as written. Other than that last section, does it need to go back for clarification if we decide to affirm the rest of the decree? Does it still need to go back to address that tax issue?
I don't think so. I don't think that the court would need to remand solely for the purpose of entering an amended decree or an amended order that states more clearly that that is the case. If in this court's decision it notes that the appellee conceded that the appellant's interpretation of that order is inaccurate. And then I just wanted to address very quickly the issue regarding the attorney fees and costs, that the appeal from that order. We mentioned this in passing in the answering brief, but in an order state, this has had a convoluted history regarding the stay orders and what has occurred in this court and bounced back to the Superior Court. But in the order staying the appeal filed on September 15th of 2025, this court noted that the August 21, 25 attorney fee judgment omitted Rule 78C language and ordered the appellant to file a motion asking the Superior Court to enter a signed judgment with Rule 78C language by October 16 of 2025. The appellant didn't meet that deadline. They didn't file anything in the Superior Court. Under the terms of that order staying the appeal then, the appellant's appeal from the August 21, 2025 attorney fee judgment should be dismissed. It should not be addressed, pardon me, by this panel on appeal. And with that, unless you have questions for me.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Jansen, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just make a couple of points as far as rebuttal. Wife seems to rely quite a bit on the Constantine 1 decision. I think this court clearly understands that that was a specific situation where the parties entered into an agreement on the record. That's what the court found, and that this court left open the division of property to the trial court later on. So I think this court's reading of that is accurate. There is no application of Constantine 1 to the division of property here, and I certainly would argue that there's no interpretation of that that becomes evidence of a 50-50 agreement as to the properties that we're dealing with now. You asked Mr. Hsu the question, what is the best evidence that you have of a 50-50 agreement? And he cited a number of things. One, the Articles of Organization, which I think you, Justice Beck, seem to suggest that probably doesn't get them there. Articles of Organization do nothing more than give you a membership interest in the LLC. And I would point out that what's the point of needing an operating agreement, oral or otherwise, if all you have to do is stick your name on an articles of organization? So that's not evidence that the parties agreed to divide things 50-50.
But by the same token, that's why we do written operating agreements if it's going to be unequal, correct?
That's correct. Certainly there would be no disagreement for me, Your Honor, that parties should always have written operating agreements, but I suppose it's those sorts of decisions that keep us all in business. So here we are today addressing otherwise. Secondly, he spent a lot of time on the Athens LLC issue. I think I've addressed that sufficiently in terms of the Constantine ruling. We don't think that that's evidence at all of an agreement to divide 50-50. Well, what about this notion that they divided rents and other things like that along the way from the properties? Well, I think that's typically what you do in an LLC. We're not disputing that wife shouldn't be entitled to her share of things like the profits. What we're arguing is that husband should be returned his capital contribution, and then whatever is left over.
Your friend brought up the K-1s. What, if any, relevance should we draw from the K-1s from these entities?
The K-1s from the entity? I don't think that the K-1s, the K-1s again, are I've got a membership interest in an LLC, and I have to pay taxes on whatever distributions I received from the LLC. That's not evidence that we agreed to divide everything 50-50. It's probably evidence that she got some distributions and she probably owed some taxes based on those distributions, but not it doesn't get you to 50-50.
If those distributions were 50-50 or thereabouts, is that evidence?
It's evidence that they divided profits 50-50, rents 50-50, anything else that may have been generated, but it doesn't get them past the problem that there's a capital contribution that must be returned.
And when we say the decision relating to Athens isn't controlling, it's not binding on anything, but it did evidence that they had an agreement in that case to just treat everything as 50-50 regardless of the. And it, was there some suggestion that we had that agreement in this case, but not as to anything else? Was there a specific argument to that effect?
Yeah, I think I agree with what you're saying. There's no dispute that there was an agreement as to the Athens, the distribution of the property under the Athens LLC.
But why couldn't there be an inference that this is the course of dealing between these parties, that this is how they're treating these LLCs?
As I recall that specific instance, Your Honor, the parties agreed on the record that they would divide that particular property however they agreed to divide it. It was very specific to that LLC and to that property.
Well, and that's because that was the only one that was at issue in that case.
Correct.
But that suggests that their course of dealing at that point was, we have an overall agreement that we're pooling assets and everything's going to be divided 50-50. Isn't there at least an inference that can be drawn from that?
I would actually take the opposite position, that by kicking the issue down the road and not taking a position as to the other assets, this court said we're not going to decide
that. It's just
what
agreed. The court didn't resolve anything. But I'm saying the parties agreed that they had their understanding was we're pooling our resources and this asset's divided 50-50 regardless of who put money into the LLC.
Certainly that ended up being the agreement as to that specific asset. But there's not enough evidence to suggest that expands to everything else. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor. I thank you for...
Could I ask one more question?
Yes.
I just want to get your perspective on the tax issue. If, for whatever reason, we decide that nothing else needs to change in the decree, does this need to go back for clarification of the language on the tax issue, or is your friend's concession on the record here today sufficient?
I think my friend's concession on the record is sufficient. I would agree, so long as the parties agree that they are going to pay their own taxes based on whatever the ultimate division is, we're okay with that. I don't necessarily think if that's the only issue that is addressed or that is not reversed, I think this court can address that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, we appreciate your briefs. We appreciate your argument today. We will take the matter under advisement, and we'll issue a written ruling in due course. Court is adjourned.